You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll hear from an astrobiologist who's dedicated her career to advancing the search for extraterrestrial life.
Right now, the Children's Health Insurance Program, it's also known as CHIP, provides states with the money to help provide children health insurance when their families are unable to afford it. The program's current spending plan expired 1 month ago, and Congress has yet to approve new funding.
The House of Representatives plans to vote on a Republican bill this week that would renew funding for CHIP. The plan could make cuts to the Affordable Care Act's public health fund and charge wealthy Medicare recipients more for their coverage. Democrats are objecting to those measures, and doctors left dealing with uncertainty now about the future coverage of their young patients.
Dr. Dipesh Navsaria is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also the vice president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Navsaria, welcome back to Central Time.
You're welcome. I'm pleased to be here.
So can you give us a sense of how the Children's Health Insurance Program, also known as CHIP, works and who actually benefits from the program?
Certainly. The CHIP program, which is known as BadgerCare or BadgerCare Plus in Wisconsin, was originally designed in 1997 to kind of fill an interesting gap that we had in health coverage for children. Some families made a little bit too much money for Medicaid, but generally didn't fall into income or job categories where they would be able to get insurance to their employer. So you had kids that were going without insurance, which is something that we as a society didn't really feel comfortable about. The CHIP program was passed on a bipartisan basis in 1997 to kind of fill that gap. Different states have enacted it differently. It's basically a state-federal partnership. And in Wisconsin, as I said, it's known as BadgerCare Plus. And that essentially covers about 172,000 children in Wisconsin.
So that's a pretty significant amount of children that benefit from this coverage. So far as you know, where does CHIP funding or BadgerCare Plus funding in Wisconsin stand today?
Well, right now it's in a fairly uncertain position, as it is in every other state as well. The CHIP program has been reauthorized a number of times since 1997, and usually with overwhelming bipartisan support. It just has not been an issue that's controversial at all. However, the funding has run out as of September 30th in terms of the federal promise to continue paying for CHIP. Now, different states are in different places in terms of when the money runs out in their own state. The handful of states where it's running out much sooner, some states, including Wisconsin, have a buffer zone of a few months just in terms of, you know, how the spending has gone and how they've chosen to enact their programs. The problem, however, for all states is that this is uncertainty, and at some point they'll start saying, you know, if you're eligible for CHIP, well, we might need to actually pull back on that eligibility because we're not sure if we're going to be able to pay for you. So now we're at almost, 29 days since Congress didn't act in time, and we're still waiting for them to act and be able to give states certainty, knowing that the CHIP funding is actually coming.
And what position does that put families in, usually when you feel as though you're about to run out of something, especially with insurance, you might want to go to the doctor and get all of your appointments done. So what kind of uncertainty does that put families in the state?
Well, I think some families might think, gee, we may not have this insurance any further, so yes, let's go and get our visits in or get refills on medications or whatever the case may be. To be perfectly honest, I'm not sure that many families actually understand that they are at risk of losing CHIP. I think it's something that the health systems and clinic systems and that the Department of Health Services at the state level are fully aware of, but I don't know if so many families necessarily recognize this. So they may be in for a very cruel surprise when they're suddenly told that, hey, this wasn't refunded and your child no longer has health insurance. And that puts them in a very difficult position in order to get the kind of preventive care that we focus on so much in pediatrics.
And state officials, you know, largely will not want to have, you know, this funding go away. So in the event that, you know, federally feet still drag on this and Wisconsin basically has to pick up the pieces, where will that money come from?
Well, that money could come if Wisconsin decides to try to continue with the CHIP program. It's going to be coming from state revenues, from the state budget. So where it's taken from, that depends on our state government just deciding where that'll happen. Clearly, we don't have, you know, millions upon millions of dollars lying around. Otherwise, we would be doing much else with it. So they may be in a position where they have to scale back the level of coverage or the way the coverage works. This is a problem because, I mean, really, the CHIP has been remarkably successful. I mean, we now cover about 96-97% of children in our state, and this is true through most of the country. This has been a remarkable success from a public health perspective, from a general medical care perspective, and so on. And it's really being threatened right now by this congressional inaction.
Can you talk a little bit about the successes that came with CHIP when it was put in place in 1997?
Well, essentially, it meant that we no longer had to rely on charity care or free clinic systems, et cetera, for children that were uninsured through no fault of their own. We have to remember that we basically have a system where insurance is either through Medicaid because you don't make a whole lot, or that it's through the fact that your parent happens to be lucky enough to have a job that provides it as a benefit, provides private health insurance as a benefit. So it left kids in this sort of middle ground there. Now, the kinds of things that we often do in pediatric visits are preventive in nature. It's immunizations, it's advice, it's checking on growth, checking on development. The sorts of things that, if they're not addressed, actually create fairly significant long-term problems that are much harder to fix later on because we're losing some of that period of brain plasticity and so on that are there. So when we don't offer insurance, particularly for children, what we end up seeing is that these problems fester and then become lifelong issues as opposed to something that we might have been able to head off earlier.
So easier to treat children earlier where, you know, they might be able to bounce back a little bit more versus having long-term health issues that they might have to deal with as adults where it might be harder to treat?
Indeed, and actually, if you look at Medicaid data, it's not just that it's easier to treat, it's also cheaper to treat children and to address their needs. If you look at Medicaid, more than half of Medicaid recipients are children, but they account for something in the neighborhood of 20 to 25% of total Medicaid costs. Kids are not a big driver of cost, and the CHIP program itself is relatively inexpensive, so the fact that we're sitting here with this inaction, it's not that it's going to break the federal budget to reauthorize CHIP. And unfortunately, what's happening right now appears to be that Congress is seemingly unable to act. The reauthorizations, at least the House reauthorization, seems to be tied to taking money from other programs like Social Security and so on. The Senate bill isn't, but I think there's a lot of wrangling going on, and CHIP is being used as a, no pun intended, or maybe it is intended, as a bargaining chip that has nothing to do with health care for children.
And I want to get to that in just a second, but I want to remind our listeners that we're talking to Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria. He's an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's also the vice president of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And right now we are talking about the delay in renewing the Children's Health Insurance Program, also known as CHIP, known as BadgerCare Plus in Wisconsin, and how it could impact families in the state. And as a doctor, what is the mood in, you know, the profession right now, seeing these sort of policy fights happening?
Well, I think it creates a lot of uncertainty. I mean, the big uncertainty we had over the last few months was Medicaid. For, you know, despite all the talk about the Affordable Care Act and, you know, whether it was going to be repealed and what it might be replaced with and so on, the thing that was snuck in there that didn't get a lot of attention until later was the fact that there were absolutely enormous cuts to Medicaid. And just to give you an idea of how that impacts children in Wisconsin, I told you that we had 176,000 kids or so covered under Badger Care. Well, Medicaid is over 500,000 children in Wisconsin alone. So that was an even larger threat, was were we going to see cutbacks in what children and their parents were eligible for, and how was that going to affect the health and well-being of children and families throughout the state?
healthcare has been, you know, a big part of what seems to be a big political fight right now. It has been a political fight for decades. I mean, you look back at the Clinton administration, but it really feels as though it has reached a head with this administration, you know, and it's pitting Democrats against Republicans. Do you think that there's anything that can be done to reduce some of the political divisions around this issue?
I think that there needs to be a commitment among policymakers on whatever side, whichever party they're in or not. I think there needs to be a commitment to saying this needs to be about ideas and not about scoring talking points or posturing for, you know, re-election or whatever this needs to happen. That this really needs to be about big ideas, and those big ideas need to be the things that we as a society, I think, largely agree on. I think that people should have insurance and should have a way of receiving care so that problems don't become worse, so that we don't all end up paying more, you know, in bills that aren't paid, et cetera, because someone's uninsured. I think we need to all agree that, hey, it's a good thing to make sure that children are covered and that we shouldn't be holding programs like CHIP hostage because we're trying to think about how we can maneuver politically to get something else done.
Dr. Nafsaria, thank you so much for being able to join us to talk about this today.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us to talk about the delay in renewing funds for the Federal Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP.
Talk to me, guys.
Partially polarized set of moving pulses, amplitude modulated.
We're locked. Systems check out. Signal across the board. What's the frequency?
4.4623 gigahertz. Hydrogen times pi. Told you.
Strong sucker, too.
I got it! I'm patched in!
All right, let me hear it.
That was part of the opening sequence of the 1997 movie Contact, starring Jodie Foster, who plays a scientist working for SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Contact was, of course, a work of fiction, but real-life scientists today are working to find evidence of life beyond planet Earth.
Margaret Turnbull joins us now. She's an astrobiologist, and she has worked with NASA and SETI in efforts to identify planetary systems that may support life. And she'll be speaking at the 2017 Wisconsin Science Festival this Friday. Maggie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much, and thank you for playing a clip of my favorite movie of all time.
Oh, we are going to get to Contact in just a minute, because I also love this movie. But, you know, for those who might hear astrobiologist, what exactly, you know, do you do as an astrobiologist?
Astrobiology is a really big field, and a lot of scientists do a lot of different things within astrobiology, but all of us do something related to the search for life on other planets. My specialty is with the stars and their characteristics and behavior, which ones make good parents for life that might be on planets orbiting them. And I work with teams to build cameras where we can actually take pictures of and study planets orbiting those kinds of stars, especially Earth-like planets in the habitable zone.
And how did you get into this kind of work?
Basically, I was an astronomy student as an undergrad, and everybody in the whole world, I think, probably finds the topic of aliens to be interesting. I grew up watching Star Trek and always loved it, loved the idea of exploring and interacting with other, especially intelligent life forms. But as an astronomy undergrad, you know, I was trying to be all serious about my studies. And then the movie Contact came out, and I just felt sort of inexorably drawn toward that part of my field. And it just so happened that right around that time, the field of astrobiology began to really grow in the hearts and minds of many of my colleagues as well. And now NASA actually has a whole astrobiology institute with many universities and NASA centers involved in different aspects of the search for life in other worlds. So I came in at a really lucky time and have pretty much devoted my whole career to it.
Now, you were really excited when we started this conversation because we did open with a pretty pivotal scene in Contact, and you said that it made an impression on you. A little bit of a confession, I also love this movie, as I said. I remember that scene really, really well. And, you know, for people who, like me, are not necessarily scientists, when they see science fiction like that in movies like Contact, you know, how close is that to what someone like you does every single day?
Well, there are a lot of departures from reality in that film. You know, for example, listening with headphones to radio signals and hearing, you know, thinking that we're going to hear something with our human ears that can't be analyzed much more efficiently with a computer. But there are many aspects of that film that are not very far from reality. The fact that, you know, we go to these big observatories and we spend day and night there with our colleagues and talking science nonstop and trying to be creative about how we can approach problems from different angles with very limited resources, having to deal with political upheaval and changes that force us to, you know, rebudget and reformulate how we're going to do our various experiments. You know, that's all pretty realistic, actually.
So some of the more bureaucratic parts of that movie feel a little bit more familiar to you. So,
yeah.
You know,
painfully so.
Yeah, sure. So we're talking to Margaret Turnbull right now. She's an astrobiologist, and she's worked with organizations such as NASA and SETI, that is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And part of the work she does is working to identify planetary systems that might support life. So separating fact from fiction, obviously Contact, not pure, true stories. But, you know, some of the science is kind of interesting. You look at similar star systems. You were saying just a few minutes ago that you helped develop cameras that can try to identify these planets that might be habitable for life. You know, how do you approach that when you go to work every day?
Well, we work in increasingly larger teams for a project like this. The specific camera that I'm working on, that I'm supporting in its development, is to go on a Hubble-class space telescope mission that would fly in its own orbit around the sun just outside the Earth's orbit. And a mission of that scale requires a lot of people to be involved with a lot of different skills. So my daily life is involves a lot of phone calls, actually, a lot of conference calls with people all over the country. There's not really any one place now that hosts like an entire team of people that would be able to carry out a mission like this or build an instrument like this. So I spend a lot of time, you know, I wake up in the morning, run the dog, and then I get straight onto the computer, and we do a lot of WebExing and Adobe Acrobat conferencing and exchange slides and do a lot of calculations on the fly and talk about what needs to be done next and kind of all go away and do our part of the research and then come back the next day with what we think the answers are and where we think we need to go next. And then a lot of it is calls that are programmatic in nature, where we're responding to the changing political landscape, like I just referred to. And we have to have reviews, external reviews of our mission to make sure that we're staying within the cost and scope, scientific scope that was envisioned for the mission. And we're just constantly responding to feedback and directions from NASA headquarters. And then I get to do fun things like go do science on tap at a tavern somewhere, or give a public lecture, or, you know, spend some time on the phone with you talking about this in terms that, you know, other people can appreciate and enjoy as well.
So for people who might be curious about, you know, the potential for life in other parts of the universe, really quickly, what criteria do astrobiologists, astronomers look for when they look at a planet that could support life? What makes that potentially habitable?
Right. Well, that is actually a very hot question in our field right now. How do we build a camera so that it will be able to detect the right kinds of things, the right kinds of, say, spectral signatures of the planet, that we would be able to really recognize, yeah, that's potentially a habitable planet right there, or even be able to say that planet does seem to have life on it. What are the signatures that you need to look for? And everything we're doing is relying on light, the electromagnetic spectrum. And we are looking, with this camera, we're looking at planets that are reflecting starlight to us. So they're in orbit around their star, and that star is shining on them. And then the reflected light bounces off that planet and eventually makes its way all the way to Earth, or all the way to our telescope. And we can see the color of the planet. We can see if it's changing in color over time, maybe because it's rotating, maybe because it has cloud patterns that are coming in and out of view, or continents or oceans that are coming in and out of view. We're not going to be able to take really high-resolution images of the planet to where we can actually see the outlines of continents and oceans, but we will be able to detect a speck of light, and we'll be able to see what color it is and if it's changing over time.
And Maggie, really quickly, because we are a little bit short on time, but
sure.
You know, thinking ahead in the future, if you were to find that there was life out there, you know, what would that look like to you? What would your reaction be?
Well, I would just be overjoyed and probably just bask for a while in the fact that we now know this. What kind of impact it actually has on humanity and on us as individual people, you know, within our own hearts, is totally unpredictable. And I guess I love that. I love that we could be in a whole new regime where all of these, you know, individual sort of thoughts and feelings about it come together and kind of create a new landscape for us.
Maggie, thank you so much for joining us. That was Margaret Turnbull. She's a freelance astronomer and astrobiologist. She'll be speaking at the Wisconsin Science Festival this Friday. You can find a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
First, Special Counsel Robert Mueller released his first charges today in his special investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election. The charges are against three former Trump campaign officials, former campaign chairman Paul Manafort, Manafort's longtime associate Rick Gates, and former Trump foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos.
Keith Darden is a professor in the School of International Service at American University. Keith, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What do we know so far about the charges filed?
Well, we know that Paul Manafort was working as a foreign agent for the Ukrainian government and some of its successor organizations. So Viktor Yanukovych and then the Party of Regions, and after the Yanukovych government was out of power, and a party called the Opposition Bloc, and that he was hiding his service for a foreign power from the U.S. government, and that he was being paid pretty handsomely for doing this, and he was also hiding those rewards in shell companies in Cyprus and some other offshore locations, and he was laundering that money through real estate in New York and Virginia.
When you say acting as a foreign agent, what does that mean as far as we know of today?
It means that he was lobbying on behalf of the Ukrainian government secretly. So it's okay to lobby on behalf of foreign governments, but you have to register that you're acting as a foreign agent with the U.S. federal government, because the U.S. government keeps track of essentially what foreign governments are doing on our soil. And Manafort and his companies were secretive about this. They didn't declare themselves even as lobbyists, let alone as foreign agents. But they were paying U.S. lobbying firms and organizing a campaign to sort of make the Ukrainian government under Viktor Yanukovych look better than it was.
And what about the charges that apply to Rick Gates and George Papadopoulos?
So Gates is basically, those are just along with Manafort's charges, that they're in this together. Gates is essentially Manafort's lieutenant. Papadopoulos is a different story. Papadopoulos was you know, working for the Trump campaign from approximately March 2016, and And he is charged with having lied to federal prosecutors about, in particular, lying about his contact with the Russians. And that he apparently had been solicited by a Russian professor who was located in London to set up a set of meetings between Putin and Trump. But also he was informed that they had thousands of incriminating emails and that the Russians were interested in helping the Trump campaign. And that he lied about that to federal prosecutors. Which suggests that there's a lot more there than the Trump campaign has previously disclosed.
What can you tell us about the role that Papadopoulos played in President Trump's campaign?
So, you know, like Carter Page, you know, there's sort of these names of minor figures, but you know, Trump didn't declare very many official advisors to his campaign. It was a relatively small campaign, so he was kind of a bit player. But he kept reporting up the chain of command to Manafort and others that he was engaging in contact with the Russians, and he was reporting what they were telling him, trying to establish relations. And they were encouraging him in these efforts. So he himself is not a terribly important figure, but he's important in that he has knowledge of some of the inner workings of the campaign. And as a result of that, he might prove to be a very useful witness now that the FBI has turned him.
When you look at the indictments as of Monday afternoon right now, how significant are they?
These are pretty significant indictments for Paul Manafort and for Gates. They've committed a number of felonies. The evidence that's provided in this indictment is stunning. I mean, from a scholarly perspective, we rarely get this kind of thorough investigation of the relationships between shell companies and money laundering. It's very hard to trace, and they've really done their homework. This is very much a slam dunk indictment. And so I think that at the very least, Manafort is going to be indicted for conspiring against the United States, for money laundering, for acting as a foreign agent, without disclosing his role. And these are all felonies that carry a minimum one-year sentence. And all of them together is probably going to amount to something close to a life sentence for Paul Manafort. And also the FBI is going to expropriate, to take away all of his property, because arguably the tens of millions of dollars that Manafort received for his services ended up buying the real estate that his family has lived in and paid for his daughter's tuition, and all of that is going to be claimed by the U.S. government. And so he's likely to have everything taken away from him and his family. And it's a pretty significant indictment from his perspective.
We're talking with Keith Darden from American University right now about the first indictments to come out of the special investigation into alleged Russian meddling in the U.S. election. And the Mueller investigation has been top secret. There have been very few data points for people to digest in terms of trying to get a sense of what direction the investigation is heading. Now that we have these indictments and a sense of the evidence, what can you triangulate from that about what Mueller is interested, how deep the investigation goes, and what his approach might be?
So what Mueller has done is reveal the basic mechanism through which Paul Manafort acts illegally as a foreign agent and is paid for that service by foreign powers. And so in this case, the foreign agent or the foreign government that he was acting on behalf of was the Ukrainian government. But it shows that he's created all of these shell companies in Cyprus that foreign governments could pay into, or foreign entities could pay into, to contract for his services, and that he would keep these secret from the U.S. government. And that we don't know, essentially, who has been paying Paul Manafort, in particular, who might have been paying him during the period of time when he was acting as Donald Trump's campaign manager, and what services he rendered in exchange for those payments. And I think that what Mueller is signaling is that we have an unethical person who is willing to serve foreign paymasters and who created an elaborate conveyor belt to get that money into the United States. and to get it involved in U.S. politics in some way. And what is on the other end, we probably are going to find out in the next couple of months. I think these were the slam dunk cases where he could clearly be charged, because this is when the system was set up. But what we still don't know is what he was doing during the course of 2016, and whether Russian oligarchs or the Russian government or Russian intelligence was financing some of his activities.
Keith Darden stays with us now. He's from American University. We're talking about the new indictments to come out of a special investigation into alleged Russian meddling in the U.S. election.
And you can join the conversation now by calling 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about today's news? What do you think about the charges released so far? And what do you make of President Trump's reaction? And, you know, what would you like to see come out of the investigation? You can give us a call now at 800-642-1234. Again, that is 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll continue our conversation, maybe take some of your calls in just a minute here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're picking up our discussion now about the first charges coming out of Robert Mueller's special investigation into possible Russian meddling in the U.S. election.
And you can join the conversation now by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of the special investigation so far? Do you think that it needed to happen or did not need to happen? And what is your take on the news today? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And of course, you can also email us at ideas@WPR.org.
As we look at the reaction to the indictments from the White House and beyond, here's Press Secretary Sarah Sanders at today's press briefing.
There's no intention or plan to make any changes in regards to special counsel. But look, today's announcement has nothing to do with the president, has nothing to do with the president's campaign or campaign activity. The real collusion scandal, as we've said several times before, has everything to do with the Clinton campaign, Fusion GPS, and Russia. There's clear evidence of the Clinton campaign colluding with Russian intelligence to spread disinformation and smear the president to influence the election. We've been saying from day one there's been no evidence of Trump-Russia collusion, and nothing in the indictment today changes that at all.
And Keith, what do you make of that response, that statement today from Sarah Sanders at the press briefing?
It's quite a dodge. I mean, I think that to say that getting the Fusion GPS material is getting information from Russian intelligence is quite a stretch. It's from a former employee of British intelligence. But also that was a firm that was contracted by Marco Rubio, and then that information was purchased by the Clinton campaign. So I don't think there's anything particular to the Clintons about this, nor was there anything illegal about it. This was not the effort of a foreign government to influence the campaign.
Is there anything unusual about it? About the Clinton campaign picking up where the other one left off?
No, that's fairly common. I think what's unusual about it is that we would have a kind of dossier like that about an American presidential candidate. I mean, there's material in that dossier which suggests that Donald Trump was engaged in corrupt real estate deals involving Russian citizens, and that was part of what the Kremlin was originally interested in with him. And so that there seems to be based on that dossier, more long-term collaboration between Trump and at least some aspects of the Russian sort of criminal world or intelligence world, and sometimes those two overlap quite a bit in the contemporary period.
We got a question from Lisa in Oconomowoc who wanted to know about the timing, why it was announced, she says, Friday, that it would be announced today, maybe giving the president, she thinks, the opportunity to point the finger more at Hillary Clinton's campaign. What do you think about the timing here? Is there anything that strikes you as unusual about it?
I think that's right. I think that the fact that the release of the indictment was leaked last week, and there were rumors of it beginning on Wednesday, I would say, I started to hear noise about it. And I think that's possibly to allow for a preemptive counterstrike from the Trump administration. And they certainly went all out on Twitter and in social media in an effort to discredit anything that Mueller might do or say in the coming days. But really, this indictment has so profoundly overshadowed those comments. It's so thoroughly researched that I think that there's not much that they could do. Those were kind of desperate efforts at the end of last week and over the weekend.
These indictments have been treated as the first indictments. Is that accurate, or could this be it?
It's very unlikely that this would be it. It's clear that they're investigating other people involved in the campaign. There's a lot of discussion that this is standard practice among federal prosecutors to try and come down hard in an early period on one of the lieutenants in a criminal organization in an effort to get them to turn on superiors and also to remind others what the consequences might be if they don't cooperate with the investigation. And everything we've seen in terms of leaks throughout the fall and throughout the summer suggests that there's more on Manafort as well, that there's more indicating that there's a direct collusion between Manafort and Russian agents, not just Ukrainian agents. In particular, he reached out through one of his former employees who was originally in Russian intelligence, a man named Konstantin Kilimnik, to try to communicate with Oleg Deripaska, who's one of the wealthiest men in the world, the head of the second largest aluminum company, who's very close to the Kremlin, in the hope that by providing them with information about the Trump campaign and collaborating with them in some way, it might forgive the $100 million debt that he owed to Deripaska, that is Manafort owed to Deripaska. And so I think there's going to be a lot more coming out. I think it's likely that we're going to see activity surrounding the president's family, possibly the president himself. Certainly Michael Flynn, we've already seen enough in the public domain to know that he's engaged also in acting as a foreign agent without reporting it, and that he's received payments that he did not correctly account for on his taxes or on his clearance forms for intelligence purposes. So I think this is really only the beginning.
Let's take a quick call here. We've got Connie with us in Montello. Connie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
My question is, what is the relationship between Trump and Manafort? Apparently Manafort's been doing this for a while. How long has he and Trump known each other, and when did Trump pull him into the campaign?
Connie, thanks for that. And Keith, what is the nature of the relationship there and the length of it?
So there's no indication that this is a longstanding relationship and that Manafort appears to have approached Trump, not the other way around, and offered his services for free. And Trump was receptive to this. We don't know exactly what the conditions were that would lead to that contract, essentially, to bringing in Manafort, in particular, to putting him in such a prominent role, ultimately as campaign manager. And I think that's one of the things that Mueller is going to have to dig into. It's possible that this tie was suggested to the Trump people by the Russian side, because Manafort and the Russians have a much closer relationship. And it doesn't seem that Trump and Manafort each other had much to bind to them.
Connie, thank you for that. And Keith, just briefly, about 20 seconds left as we wrap up. Do the indictments indicate that the investigation is nearing its closure, or that there's still legwork to be done?
There's definitely still legwork to be done. I think what they've indicated is the primary mechanism of influence, at least the one that worked through Manafort, and the way in which money might have made its way into American politics, and that people closely involved with the Trump campaign could have been paid as foreign agents and kept that secret from both the U.S. government and the American people.
Keith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Keith Darden is a professor in the School of International Service at American University, joining us there to talk about the first indictments out of the special investigation into Russian meddling in U.S. politics. Those charges were released this morning.
college students obtaining music and movies on the sly has been going on for years, but computer experts at the University of Wisconsin-Madison say illegal downloading has gone down, way down. Shemaine Mills looks at what's changed.
Technology changes over time, and so have the ways in which it's used. But one constant on college campuses has been computers delivering entertainment to student eyes and ears.
Okay, here's the Tom Petty song that I downloaded.
I caught up with sophomore Tal Rubenstein 14 years ago in his dorm room on the Madison campus. The Milwaukee native was using an online file sharing site to get music. Such sites were free and illegal, but oh so popular. Sharing copyrighted music was rampant. There's still illegal file sharing going on, but a lot less of it, say campus computer experts like Brian Rust of UW-Madison's IT department. The UW has sent 213 notices of copyright violation to students on campus so far this year.
That equates to about an 85% drop from 2016 totals and an 89% drop from 2015 totals.
Illegal downloading on campus has plummeted since the evolution of iTunes, Spotify, and other music services where people pay or listen to commercials for access to copyrighted entertainment. Those sites came after the pioneering free sharing site Napster was shut down by the courts in 2001. This original online music startup is a distant memory to today's college students.
Have you ever heard of Napster?
Yeah, it's old though. Because I was in, like, middle school when that was a thing.
I remember Napster.
You were too young to use it.
Yeah, I think that any music I wanted at that age, I had a CD of.
That's Anna Schuett and Roman Pertzborn. Both say they use legitimate services to get licensed music. Pertzborn says concern about copyright laws isn't what keeps him away from file-sharing sites.
The quality is just not there with all those free sharing things. Most of the time it's too hard to find the songs I personally want.
While more of the music heard on campus is now obtained legally, movies are a different matter. They make up the bulk of ill-gotten entertainment, says Rust.
It's been primarily, if not almost exclusively, movies, like first-run movies, you know, a movie that hasn't even necessarily hit the theaters yet, or something that's been released in another country. Somebody obtains a copy of that, they put it on their server and offer it to the rest of the world.
Then and now, the music and movie industries have threatened to sue those taking copyrighted material for free using file-sharing software. Over the years, UW-Madison has gotten only a couple of subpoenas, Russ said, but lots of cease and desist letters, which are passed along to the alleged offenders.
We let people use the network in order to do their work. They may look at things that you and I might consider inappropriate. We don't act on those things until or unless we get a complaint.
At the start of the fall semester, campus officials sent out a notice about copyright rules, a pointed reminder that there could be expensive consequences to illegally downloading music and movies for free. Jimmy Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.